Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
Gazing up to the night sky saying, are we alone? It's like, well, wait a minute, look around. There's tons of fascinating life forms. We're so lucky to have all this amazing panoply of life on the planet. It's not to say, I get the question, you know, okay, are there other humanoids out there, or are there other, you know, conscious beings? But we ought to be pretty grateful for what we have on this planet. You know, there's a lot of amazing creatures and phenomena that we get to enjoy living with if we can.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Jonathan Balcombe. Jonathan is a biologist with a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior. He's the author of 4 books, including the New York Times bestseller, What a Fish Knows. And he can most recently be seen in the Netflix documentary, Seaspiracy. Jonathan, hi. Thank you so much for being here today. It's awesome to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Beth. Thanks.
Hey, so I want to talk about fish because all the rage at the moment is Seaspiracy. Congratulations on your part in it. I thought you were fantastic.
It's an honor to be part of that film, given that it's trending so much.
That film is everywhere, and it's like in the top 10.
Is it? I didn't know that. Good to hear.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 40 countries. My only qualm was your part. I loved your part, but I wanted more.
You're sweet.
No, I did because, you know, it's this film bringing us all this concern about what we're doing to the oceans and to fish, but we need to know more about the fish themselves, the individuals. And so the film's incredible. And you are the man who knows a lot about fish, being that you wrote What a Fish Knows. Before we even start with that, Jonathan, I want to talk a little about you. Because you know so much about so many animals, how they think, feel, why they matter. And you've been doing this for a really long time. And so did you grow up with this level of compassion and concern? And was this part of kind of who you were as a kid?
Yeah, well, first off, credit to the scientists who do the research that I synthesize. You know, I don't do animal studies directly anymore, although I love observing them, and I certainly do a lot of that. But, you know, they do some creative and remarkable stuff that I like to bring to light in my books. This topic's been with me my whole life. From my earliest memory, I absolutely adored animals. As a kid, if somebody squashed a caterpillar or an ant under their foot, I felt more alienated from them by far than I did the little creature that they crushed. That was with me from the earliest memory. So it was probably only a matter of time before, A, I studied biology, and B, I went into animal protection as sort of my career for the next couple of decades before I started focusing more and more on writing books.
When did you go vegan?
1989, I stopped buying all animal products. 84, I went vegetarian. And at that time, I was amazed that it took me that long to come to that realization, given how much passion I have for animals. And then 89, I thought, you know, if I'm vegetarian, well, they still slaughter the animals that we take milk from and eggs from, or I should say who we take those things from. So their life is no better and arguably worse. To be morally and ethically consistent, it made so much more sense to stop buying eggs and milk. Of course, I buy tons of milk, but it's just not made from cows or goats. It's made from plants. It's nice to have those options now. So yeah, 89, I sort of called myself a domestic vegan for a while. It was a sort of a transitional period where I would still go to a restaurant or go to someone's place and not ask them if they'd put cream in the dessert or what have you. In time, I worked for organizations that took a more, strident stance on that. And it made sense. And it's, as I say, it's become a lot easier anyway to be vegan now. It's very easy. It has this, still has this stigma of being challenging, but it's a stigma that's not deserved.
Yeah, no, it's true. But it's now, I'm sure, compared to back in the day when you first went vegan, there's no comparison.
Oh, no comparison at all.
You got your PhD in ethology, which is the study of animal behavior. Was ethology a big thing in the terms of, were many people really looking at, you know, the actual lives of animals and the culture and the thinking and the feeling and kind of how they matter?
Yeah, go ask someone if they know what ethology is, and you'll soon find that very few people do know what it is, which is one way of saying that it hasn't been a big field. It's been a growing field, and it's an exciting time to be an ethologist now, because scientists are asking questions about what animals are thinking, what are they feeling, that were not being asked for most, or certainly much, of the 20th century. It was actually a taboo on suggesting that animals had minds and feelings. It was a strange sort of denialist era. But for the last several decades, science has been emerging from that, and now we have all kinds of fascinating studies, you know, about animal emotions. My new book, Superfly, which is about to come out, there's even a study I describe in there asking the question, do male fruit flies enjoy ejaculating? You know, who would have thought of that, even asking that question a while ago, never mind probing that kind of question. It's not to say we necessarily have definitive answers. And by the way, there's some interest in studying potential for female pleasure in flies as well, which I think is very important. We have an even playing field there, so to speak.
I can't even imagine how someone would study this. After you wrote What a Fish Knows, did you come out of it with this whole new kind of respect for fish that...
Yeah, one way I like to put it that kind of gelled for me while I was researching and writing this book was, I had some prejudices, I had some biases, like we all do in various domains, and certainly that included this sense that fishes were, you know, a little bit maybe more primitive or less sophisticated than the other vertebrates. Having seen what we've studied about them and what we've discovered about them, came to realize that they are equals among vertebrates. We tend to be hierarchical in our thinking. I don't even like to sort of encourage that way of thinking, that, you know, one's above another or below another. Each species on Earth has its own wonderful attributes, and we should respect them all. If we are going to think hierarchically, then my conclusion is that fishes are, based on their attributes and their achievements, the ones that we've described, and there's probably many more that we haven't, based on those, they are equals among all the any terrestrial vertebrate you want to name. I mean, pick, you know, mammals, birds, fishes do stuff that's just as sophisticated. It's in a different realm, so maybe we can't relate to it as easily often. But if you probe deeply, they're doing really remarkable things through their communication, emotions, virtuous behavior, how they reproduce, how they find mates, how they solve problems, how they can learn by observation, learning and memory. They have great learning and memory. You know, these are generalizations in the sense that not every one of those 33,000 species has a fabulous memory and can, say, form a mental map. It may not be useful to them. They may not need to. Animals tend to be good at what's useful to them. Yeah. But if you look at a species for which, say, having a mental map is useful, you find that some of them have very good mental map ability, which is a form of memory.
A lot's changed and a lot's changing, but I guess there's still people who don't believe that fish feel pain. Is that true?
Yeah, and I suppose it's more common a view in the camp of those who catch fish, either for a living or for recreation. But there's good science on that. There's anatomical studies, there's physiological studies to show the same kind of biochemistry. There's studies that show that fishes have the same kind of nociceptors, which are nerve cells that are responsive to various kinds of insults, such as chemical pain, dare I say, heat pain, and mechanical pain, such as something that pierces the skin. They have those three kinds of nociceptors that we have, and when those nociceptors are stimulated through a presumably painful stimulus, the brain registers that, behavior changes, the animals remember it, fishes will seek pain-relieving drugs if they're presumably in pain. The challenge here, of course, Beth, is that we can't feel the pain of another. I can't even feel your pain, and you can't feel mine. Being humans, we can report verbally that we feel pain, and we accept that, and we can relate more easily with another human than another species, never mind a fish, where we've often not been able to recognize how they're feeling. But you can study, it's not often very humane type research, I'm not claiming that, but these studies show that these animals are equipped to feel pain. We should certainly expect them to be able to, because pain is a very useful ability. It's a way to learn to avoid dangerous things. It can take you out of the gene pool. So evolution, natural selection for pain detection is not surprisingly, it's evolved. They have the physiology and the behavior that really lines up well with the experience of pain.
When you decided, I want to write a book about fish and what we actually know now about fish that scientists know, but most people haven't even thought about. Did you go in knowing a lot of this, or was there a ton that just shocked you, fascinated you, changed you?
Mostly the latter. I mean, I knew some. I mean, I love animals. I've been reading about them all my life, and you learn as you go. But for me, when I started to research that book, I was delighted to see how much there was and how little I knew even. And I figure if I don't know much about it as somebody who studies animals and who reads a lot about them, then the average layperson, the potential reader of a book about the lives of fish is not going to know either. The fact that we had a lot of really great science about these animals, the fact that few people were aware of what the science shows us, and the fact that we, as usual, we exploit the animal that we're talking about, in this case, over 33,000 species of fish. Those three are the key criteria for me to want to study and write a book.
I thought I knew a little bit about fish until I read your book, and I realized I knew nothing. It stunned me. And first of all, I had no idea that fish have all the same senses that we have. I had no idea that they could smell and that
right.
We
and
talk
some
about,
other,
they have more than
senses,
us too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, perhaps it follows from a group of animals who've been evolving for over 400 million years. If you compress the amount of time that humans have been on the earth down to a second, then fishes have been around for about 4.5 minutes. So they've had a lot more time to evolve sophisticated systems. Living in the water gives you opportunities to have different ways of communicating. So yeah, they do have some cool sensory systems that we don't have. The lateral line of bony fishes, which is most fishes, it's a row of sensitive scales along their sides. You can actually see this line along many species, and it's these sensitive scales have little pits in them, and there's little hair-like structures that are innervated, and they respond to changes in water pressure. They respond to movement. So even in the dark, a fish can detect movements nearby, and they can use that information really well. There's quite a few species that have electric communication, certainly electric sense. There are fishes in both South America and Africa, different groups of different species, and different. It's evolved probably separately, which is pretty cool. And they use electricity for communication. This is very useful when you live in murky environments where you can't see what's going on. And a lot of the communication that fishes have with each other is kind of off the radar for other animals in their realm. So it's handy if a little fish can communicate with another one without alerting a nearby predator that they're actually talking to each other.
Wow. Humans in general, that we have a really hard time giving fish any credit whatsoever for anything, right? I mean, the fact that they feel pain is very new for most people, you know, the past decade or so, probably. So many people write fish off. I know so many people who say, I'm vegetarian, but I eat fish. And I'm like, well, they're an animal.
The last time I looked, a fish is not a vegetable, I believe.
Exactly. I would assume one reason it's they're farther away from us than a mammal, than cows.
Yes,
or,
sure. Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But it's almost like, The way we've written off fish forever and given them, you know, not a whole lot of thought, not a lot of moral consideration, not a lot of anything, it's made it really easy. How many fish are killed a year? I don't know if you know off the top of your head.
But. Yeah, they're measured by weight. So, you know, you can only make estimates. But the estimates range anywhere from a low end of several hundred billion a year to a high end of possibly as much as or more than 2 trillion. I describe that in my book as if you took an average fish and then you lined them up end to end, that row of fish would reach the sun and back with a few hundred million to spare. This is the upper end, if it was a trillion fish, and that's per year. Of course, it's so easy to forget that they're individuals with feelings. Feelings are felt not by species, but by individuals. Everyone's a unique individual with a personality, and as we said, with the capacity to feel pain and to suffer, but also to enjoy life and to have joy and pleasure, and that's important to keep that in the equation.
Do they feel pleasure, fish?
For sure, yeah. They're actually, there's a combination of science and anecdote, but a lot of fishes will approach trusted humans, and you can watch this on YouTube, who come in for petting, for being handled and held. They'll even trust their human guardian to pick them up out of the water and hold them and caress them for a few minutes. So a lot of that is anecdotal, But the behavior is pretty hard to deny that this is an animal who is drawn to pleasure. There are, however, scientific studies that support this. For instance, a study that I like to describe about using surgeon fishes. It's a reef species. They captured a bunch of them from the Great Barrier Reef, and I'm happy to say they returned them after the study to the same places. And they found that a stressed, which is to say probably unhappy, fish will gravitate to a source of pleasure. That is to say, in this case, it was a model of a cleaner wrasse that was hooked up to a motor that would wave back and forth gently, and they could get caressed from this. And this actually matches an interaction that happens on the reef where cleaner wrasses actually do caress fishes with their pectoral fins, probably to curry favor with their so-called clients for these interactions they have. These stressed fishes, surgeon fish, would swim up to this wand an average of 15 times an hour and gets caressed, and they can measure the stress hormones in the blood, and the stress levels came down towards baseline during that period, that hour to 2 hour period. The control group, who were stressed and were put in a tank with a model of a cleaner wrasse that was not hooked up to a motor, so it didn't wave back and forth, it just sat there stationary, they ignored it. They didn't go up to it because it couldn't give them caresses, and their stress levels stayed high. I don't know about you, but I mean, I can hardly imagine a more convincing way of demonstrating that a massage feels good and or relieves stress for a fish, and we already know it does that for us. I mean, when I read about that study, it was, much as I already appreciate fish's capabilities, nevertheless, my mind was blown to discover that. It's kind of sobering when you consider how many fish we abuse every year.
Well, and with 33,000 different types of fish in the ocean or more than that.
Yeah, by the way, most of which we never lay hands on there. Fortunately, largely free of our depredations, although maybe I should regret saying that, but some of the deep sea species are probably not greatly affected by us yet, and let's hope it stays that way.
That's awesome. There's so many individual fish have very specific evolutionary traits that reading your book, it's kind of shocking fact after shocking fact. What do we know about their intelligence?
Quite a bit, but probably a tiny fraction of what they know about their intelligence. There's a lot of examples I like to give. Certainly the way animals communicate is a good window into what's going on in their minds. One example I love to give that, again, it was kind of mind-blowing when I discovered it. It's an example of referential communication, which is vanishingly rare between species in nature, in any group of animals. It happens between two reef predator fishes called groupers, which are kind of big, chunky fishes that swim in the open water near the reef, and they can swim very fast and catch smaller fish to eat them. And moray eels, which are, you know, eels long and slender, but also quite large predators of reefs. And the grouper in this case will signal to the moray that he or she would like to go hunting with them. It's essentially an invitation. It's a head shake or a body shimmy. And it communicates to the moray, and it's not any old moray. It's probably Joe the moray, who they happen to know personally and have collaborated with before. And it's an invitation gesture to go out and hunt together collaboratively on the reef. And if they see a fish that they're interested in trying to catch, they pursue it. And if the fish swims into the matrix of the reef, well, the eel, kind of like a ferret, can go in there after it. And if the eel catches it, people often ask me, do they share the fish if they catch it? No, they don't. Whoever catches it eats the whole fish. But between them, because the fish has no escape route, if it swims out into the open water, the grouper's waiting. So they both do much better, estimated to be up to five times as well when they collaborate than if they go fishing alone. The purposefulness of that behavior, the flexibility that it entails, the fact that it's referential communication, and the sort of the definition here for that is that it's referring to an event. So the head shake happens somewhere else. And it's referring to a future event, catching a fish on the reef over there, some minutes later, maybe even an hour later. And in fact, groupers will point, they'll swim vertically and point their bodies towards a fish in the reef. They don't do that if there's no moray around. They do that if the moray is nearby and they can signal to them, you know, basically, come on over here, there's something worthwhile pursuing. And they'll do that for sometimes a while before the moray gets the message. So it requires patience. But definitely, it's just one example, albeit a gripping one, of a window into the intelligence and the minds of these fishes.
Going back to Seaspiracy and learning about, you know, overfishing and industrialized fishing, when they're coming out in these huge nets, they're actually really suffering.
Terribly, terribly. They're bound to be terribly suffering. I don't know if anyone's done it, but if you took a blood sample from a fish who happens to have just survived, many, if not most of them, don't, being caught in a big net and hauled onto a boat deck, or a tuna who's being gaffed and hauled onto a boat deck, you'd find astronomically high levels of stress. These are emotional animals. They have the biochemistry that shows that they feel these things. They have fear. They have stress. They can be depressed, according to at least one published study, which is to say long-term emotional profiles, not just how they're feeling at that one moment. They can be chronically stressed, and that can become kind of like depression, where they stop eating and they stop thriving and they just give up.
What was the study for that?
It was a study done, I think it was Norwegian scientists who did the study, and it was aquaculture. It was an aquaculture salmon operation. So this is fish farming. I think in this case, it probably was sea pens. I don't remember, but sea pens are sort of netted areas in ocean coastlines. So the animals are in ocean water, but they're trapped. They're kept in a net, usually at high densities. And they were talking about documenting what are called dropouts, which are individuals who just can't cope with the stresses and strains of the crowding, the competition for food, the parasites like fish lice can eat into their bodies and they can't do much about it. The chemicals used to try and treat these conditions, the antibiotics, the various incursions into their lives that they wouldn't normally face in the wild. Not to say the wild is a walk in the park or a swim in the park for a fish, but you know, at least they're free and can do what they're motivated to do, which is migrate, swim long distances. Anyway, they found that these dropouts, which apparently are very common, very widespread in salmon aquaculture, they give up and they stop eating. And there's a slide I show in my talks from the study that shows a dropout below a normal fish of the same age, a young salmon, and the dropout is about a third the size, about a third the weight. They just stop eating and they eventually float to the surface and die. They measured the stress, the cortisol levels, and they were very high in these fish. And they concluded that it looks like depression. It looks like a long-term negative affective state that we would call depression in our own species.
Would it be that surprising either anyway that they would have depression just because they seem to have pain, pleasure?
No, right. Well, great question, because in light of what we now know that they have all these other attributes, no, it shouldn't be surprising. But you know, you tell the average person that salmon can get depressed, and they'll think it's a joke is coming up. But the science actually supports that. But most people don't think that fishes are capable of that.
But not that long ago, people were saying the same thing about dogs or apes or chimps.
That's right. That's right. We have a history of underestimating animals' abilities. I mean, heck, I've just written a book on insects, flies specifically, and this book is certainly not all about fly minds and how they think and their inner lives. But I do get into that in one chapter. But suffice to say that there's so much more that they're capable of doing than that we typically believe or know.
Well, we don't really know much. Most people, I don't.
We don't, and we are left with the challenge, the reality that we can't experience what they experience any more than they can what we can. And I'm not here to say that their experience of life is the same as ours. Not at all. Not for any other animal, in fact. And we should celebrate the difference, the fact that they have their own ways of experiencing their lives. And yes, I'm the first to say that the phenomenon of experience, which requires consciousness, is not necessarily possessed of all animals. But we should be very open to the possibility. We should be very accepting of it in certainly all vertebrates. And now, you know, growing interest in invertebrates, octopuses and squids, octopuses especially. You know, my octopus teacher, another film that kind of really hit the zeitgeist of our time. Books like Other Minds, The Soul of an Octopus. There's a great deal of interest now, and it's pretty clear that consciousness evolved at least twice on this planet, because octopuses are pretty clearly conscious and emotional. And yet, it's been such a long time since our common ancestors diverged that our ancestor at that time didn't have consciousness either. So it appears to have evolved at least twice, which is pretty neat. And it says a lot about how darned useful it is to be conscious.
Yeah.
Not to mention how great it is to be able to reflect and it allows us to have kind of what we think of as a meaningful life. But maybe we'll find life on another planet and conscious life, and we'll have to say, well, at least three times consciousness has evolved in the cosmos. And chances are, statistically, with the number of galaxies, solar systems, and planets we're beginning to realize are out there in this universe, we're just a tiny, tiny speck within a speck. It's pretty sobering. What are the chances that this is the only planet with life, never mind conscious life? It just seems very, very statistically unlikely, given the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
We ought to be a little more humble about ourselves than we tend to be. We think we're the greatest gift that ever happened in the universe. Well, probably not.
It should also make us look a little more deeply at how we treat all the other beings on the planet, in the sense of, yeah, maybe there's all this other life out there, but people often talk about like, oh, if we find other life, we have all this other life here that we're
There's sort of this trope, you know, ignoring. Someone gazing up to the night sky saying, are we alone? It's like, well, wait a minute, look around. There's tons of fascinating life forms. We're so lucky to have all this amazing panoply of life on the planet. It's not to say, I get the question, you know, okay, are there other humanoids out there, or are there other, you know, conscious beings? But we ought to be pretty grateful for what we have on this planet. You know, there's a lot of amazing creatures and phenomena that we get to enjoy living with if we can.
With things like My Octopus Teacher and Cy Montgomery's book, they've gotten better PR from all this, right? And kind of in the way that whales got really good PR in the 70s, and it really changed the world for most whales, or a whole lot of whales. And what you've done with fish and your book, and now with Seaspiracy, fish are starting to finally get, you know, some good press. But what do you think, because you've written a lot of books about a lot of animals, you've studied animals and for decades, what do you think it really takes to get the bigger population to really start to change in the way that, just even in the way that people, yes, a lot of people are not paying any attention to factory farming, but they are a lot more now in 2021 than they were 10 years ago. You can see the areas that are getting traction, at least some traction. But I feel like with fish, what do you think it really takes to get people to say, hey, wait, I don't want to eat them anymore, or I don't want to participate in that anymore?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you know, there's no easy pat answer. I think as a writer, I've learned that I need to try and not just inform and not just deliver facts, but engage emotions. And the reality is that facts have been shown to not really engage emotions. It's stories that do. It's the personal aspect. It's when you think of an individual and their experience. I can say that a fish can enjoy feeling pleasure, but if I describe to you somebody's pet fish, they come home and they cup their hands in the water and the fish swims into their hand and lies on his side and his name's Jasper, and the woman strokes him with her thumb and how she felt when Jasper died years later, or say something like that. When you start to tell a story with a personal touch, that's more likely to engage our emotions. So I've learned as a science writer, it ain't just about facts and science. I think that's important, and I like including that, but I've learned to tell a lot of stories as well.
Speaking of fish in the tank at home, you are in another film that's coming out soon.
Yeah, it's called The Dark Hobby, and it's a film that focuses on the hidden problem of the aquarium fish industry. You know, a lot of people who have fishes in aquariums are well-meaning and all that, but the reality is that most fish who end up in an aquarium were wild-caught, and the methods used to catch them and the conditions with which they're handled and transported long distances, and the harsh reality that a lot of the places they end up in people's homes, the people unwittingly or otherwise are not well-equipped with how to provide them with what they need. And it may be impossible for a fish that, say, lives typically 50 meters down on a reef and now finds itself living in just, you know, a couple of feet deep of water in the tank. That fish is not gonna flourish. So I find if I see aquariums in a mall or a dentist office, next time I go back, usually there's quite a few different fish there. They've changed from the last time, and that's because they simply don't flourish and they don't tend to live long. It's been estimated that the mortality rate is about 90% from capture to destination. And within a year, about another 90% who've made it to the destination, they're gone. So it's been likened a bit to the cut flower industry, where, you know, cut flowers are not intended to live very long. They're pretty to look at, but they die. Of course, we're now talking about with fish, we're talking about sentient beings, individuals who also die. So it is sad, and it's an issue that needs to be understood by the broader public. And I hope that film will get some viewing.
Yeah, because I don't think a lot of people think about it with aquariums.
Yeah, I think most people don't think about it. And it is an extension of what we've been talking about, how we tend to demean or reduce fish is to something to be less concerned about. But, you know, we need to realize that we ought to be concerned about them too for the same reasons we're concerned about other animals.
Well, and now you're going to make us all be concerned about flies.
Well, I'm glad you said that because, you know, it's such a vast difference
in terms of
a group of animals and how we may connect with them. I do try to get people scratching their heads and thinking, you know, man, maybe there's a lot more going on here than we thought. But first of all, we don't tend to eat flies in the way we eat fish. We don't catch them in big nets and that sort of thing. It's a very different moral landscape. But the take-home message is that we need them. We have to have them. They are very troublesome to us in some cases, but the vast majority are not. If the planet suddenly was devoid of flies, we probably wouldn't be having many more of these podcasts because they run the planet. They help run the planet. Insects are 80% of all the animals on the planet. Flies are extremely successful and numerous and diverse. And the planet hums with functioning life because of them. If they disappeared, food webs would collapse and we wouldn't be able to feed ourselves and we would perish too.
Wow.
Quite as simple as that.
And that is definitely something that I don't think about. And I'm sure most people are not thinking about either.
Yeah, probably not. So hopefully a few of them will read Superfly and come out with a more awareness of that.
What's the craziest thing you learned or the most, thing that shocked you the most while you're working on it?
I guess one thing that just springs immediately to mind, this is a terrible thing to say because it's not very ingratiating. It doesn't ingratiate us towards flies, but mosquitoes are credited with killing more humans than humans have killed. They're the only animal that apparently ranks above us through history. It's been estimated that there's been an accumulation of about 112 billion humans who've walked the earth throughout the history of the human race. Somewhere over something like 52 billion of them were killed by mosquitoes, which is to say the diseases that mosquitoes carry. So yeah, pretty amazing. I need to do some more homework on what I'm going to say in media interviews about flies because that's not very ingratiating.
No.
Mosquitoes are just a particular type. I mentioned orgasms in male fruit flies a little earlier. I guess I would say here's an illustration of the incredible fecundity of flies, their capacity to reproduce. Another one that maybe not ingratiating, I'll come up with a better example. But two fruit flies breeding on January 1st in a hypothetical year. If you take just the 25th generation at the end of the year, if there were no mortality, if that 25th generation was, you know, there it is, and you're not even counting the previous 24 generations, you'd have a ball of flies that would reach from here to the sun and a little bit further. So thank goodness for ecological controls and things like, species eating other animals. How ironic, you know, we're talking about not eating animals, and that's a good thing to aim for humans, but... Yeah, it's important that there are little animals eating little animals out there to keep things in check.
That is incredible. That is just astonishing.
I learned that in my undergraduate biology degree, the introduction to the entomology textbook that we had, the insect textbook,
wow,
presented that scenario, and it was quite eye-opening.
You're working on a book right now?
Well, yes, I am. It's a children's book. It's my first children's fiction book, just a little story about a boy and a fish. It's called Jake and Ava, A Boy and a Fish. It's two parallel stories about a boy who catches a fish on his first fishing outing, and the parallel story of the fish who he ends up catching. And then, so the story coalesces at the end, the two stories, and the boy experiences kind of what I experienced when I was taken fishing as a youngster. He relates to the fish, and he feels empathy for the fish. He sees the fish suffocating and he's got a hook in its mouth and he's like, doesn't seem like a very nice situation to be in.
That's what happened to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, the beginning of my book, What a Fish Knows, I relate an experience from when I was 8 years old, being taken out fishing by a camp director. And I caught fish. I caught a bunch of fish. Most of them were thrown back, but a number of the bigger ones were kept. And you know, I saw earthworms wriggling on hooks. I didn't have to do any of the dirty work. I saw the bigger ones having a knife plunged into their head to try and kill them. It was just violent and disturbing. And it still took me many years to process that and to develop the emotional and ethical maturity that I could, you know, make the decision to remove myself or try to remove myself from those kinds of things by not purchasing the product by not eating fish. But, you know, that was years later. You know, moral evolution takes a while for the individual. And so, you know, through my work, I try to hasten that a little bit.
I do think now, so it seems now, because there's so many other external factors getting kind of piped in through social media, documentaries, everything else, that's happening a lot faster for people who are kind of already drawn to it. So a kid who would probably have gone through your experience, and then they're seeing documentaries and they're seeing, you know, videos on YouTube.
Yeah, for all the challenges we're facing, the pandemic, you know, human population growth, migrations, human refugees. I mean, there's so many issues. Nevertheless, I'm somewhat heartened and encouraged by the unprecedented moral concern and moral awareness we're beginning to show towards other animals. It's frustrating that we're still collectively going the wrong way because animal consumption is growing in some parts of the world while it's now beginning to be replaced with other technologies and other food sources in other parts of the world. It's very exciting to see that. And this stuff could be a game changer. It needs to be a game changer with the climate change that I meant to mention is another challenge we're faced with. It's all coalescing. We're beginning to realize this is all connected. The pandemic and climate change are not independent of our food choices. The food choices are very much linked to that. And so even if we're selfish, we need to change our eating habits because we're going down with the planet if the planet's going to go down. And by the way, you know, we're much more vulnerable than flies, say, and a lot of fish. They'll be around. They'll survive it. And maybe we will as a species, but we need to change our direction. We need to change our habits because if, you know, we don't, if we continue to just run roughshod over the planet, then it's us who are going to pay ultimately.
And last question I have for you. So since that we've been in the pandemic for a year, and we know that the pandemic was caused by how we treat animals. If we didn't have this relationship with animals, we wouldn't have these zoological diseases, not most of them. Do you think outside of a certain bubble that information has spread like to awareness and consciousness?
I wish I could answer yes to that, but my answer from my perspective is absolutely not. I don't think it has. Maybe it will. Maybe that connection will ultimately be made. But with all the news on the pandemic, on, you know, everybody can spell COVID-19 now and coronavirus, it's all over the news all the time. I don't see much discussion about where it came from and why and the animal element. We don't seem to have learned or be learning that lesson from this case. And a lot of people have been talking about how we're going to face this kind of stuff more and more if we keep going on our current route. It's so frustrating when you see news reports about a food poisoning outbreak, an E. coli outbreak in some shipment of spinach or tomatoes somewhere. Well, E. coli is named for the colon where the bacteria come from. It wasn't the tomatoes or the spinach. They don't have colons. It was the animal manure or some other animal product that was sprayed or put on those plants that led to the E. coli outbreak. So it's annoying when veggies get the blame. It's animal agriculture that's really ultimately responsible.
It's true. It's true. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for this. And it was great to see you in Seaspiracy. And I'm excited to see. What's the aquarium movie called?
The Dark Hobby.
The Dark Hobby. Very cool.
Thanks, Beth. A real pleasure to speak with you.
To learn more about Jonathan and his work, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.